Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this last day of 2012. Hurricane Sandy slams U.S. and drops 140 terajoules, more than twice the energy of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. The number of proton collisions generated to find Higgs boson-like subatomic particles. The Arctic ice cap reaches a new low. More dinosaurs wore feathers. The first fully bionic leg hits the market. Curiosity lands on the red planet. Voyager reaches the edge of the solar system. And on it goes. The big science stories of 2012 and what we may look forward to in terms of big science stories of 2013, this hour of the program. Jennifer Bogo is articles editor of Popular Science magazine, and that's the focus of the magazine for this month. And it's absolutely fascinating to remember what happened and also to look at what will happen. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jennifer. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave messages for us because we like to read them on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Happy New Year to you, Jennifer. Hello. Oh, she's on ISDN. That's just a fancy radio term. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Hi. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Yeah. Well, let's start with Hurricane Sandy, because I don't even know what these terajoules are and how significant this story is, but it's in the magazine. What's a terajoule, and what does it have to do with Hurricane Sandy, and why is it a big science story?
Well, everyone who experienced Sandy on the ground realized that it hit the coast with a lot of energy, and that's basically what we meant by terajoules. It actually hit with roughly twice as much energy as the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima. It was an incredibly unique event. I think it's the kind of event that scientists are looking to the future with a little bit of wariness. It might be happening a little bit more often, and so it was definitely a significant moment in science.
Mm-hmm. And will scientists make progress in 2013 in determining whether or not we're going to see more of these? Because that was it's an understatement, horrific event.
Yes, and actually in 2013, something that people should look to in terms of climate change and the sort of certainty with which scientists are looking at things like superstorms are two reports that are expected. One is the international, it's the IPCC reports, the International Panel on Climate Change. It comes along every 5 years, and there will be an update this year. The National Climate Assessment will also be released this year. And those are both basically scientific consensus reports on climate change. They look at everything scientists know right now about what's happening to the Earth's climate and what we can expect. And really, that understanding has not changed much in the past several years to decades. But these reports are a good reminder. They add certainty to the picture, and they're really a good reminder of what we can expect.
So these reports are somehow weightier than the earlier reports?
With each report and each additional study that is taken into consideration when the reports are written, they add more certainty to it. So I think each subsequent report is more significant than the last in that it's the most updated picture of what's happening to our Earth's climate right now. But really, it's not saying anything new. They're very nuanced differences from these reports to the ones that were released years earlier.
Mm-hmm. Another story in Popular Science is that the Arctic ice cap has reached a new low. Can you amplify on that story?
Sure. The Arctic ice sheet, that it's what's called the summer ice extent, has been in dramatic overall decline for several years now. And this year it actually reached its lowest extent in satellite record, which dates back 33 years. What that means is that what happens at the top of the Earth in the polar regions is that the more ice that melts during the fall period, the more the darker the top of the Earth is and the more heat it can hold and attract. And it creates this positive feedback loop that basically adds more heat and more moisture to the climate system. And we're going to start to feel the effects of that in other areas of the Earth.
Perhaps a bit of good news here, which may affect what you were just talking about, or maybe not. In 2012, biofuel took flight, 100% unblended fuel derived from a plant in the mustard family.
Yes, and there have been a few biofuel flights before, but they've always blended petroleum with some mix of biofuels. And this was a flight that took place, I believe, over Ottawa. It was in Canada. It was done by Canada's National Research Council. And it was the first flight that was entirely on unblended biofuel, and it lasted for about 20 minutes in the air. And they're now analyzing the results of that. And the early analysis indicates that the emissions indeed are lower, and the performance is equivalent to other kinds of fuel.
Mm. But it only went 20 minutes. Do we know why?
Well, it's an experimental aircraft, and it's designed to fly to reach altitude with regular jet fuel, and then to switch over to biofuel. Basically, just to this is a research program, so it's to see how it performs, what the emissions are like, and so it flies around sort of over the country just to get that data, and then it switches back to regular fuel to land. So I anticipate there will be many more follow-ups to really further analyze and get more data on the performance of the planes on this fuel.
Well, that could be a big thing for other forms of transportation too, couldn't it?
Well, certainly there's all sorts of biofuel research happening across the board in transportation. It's exciting to see what's happening with regular automobiles, vehicles. Planes, however, remain one of the biggest sort of contributors to emissions over the country. And anyone who's tracking their own personal climate change impact, any flight you take leaves quite an impact. So really nailing biofuels for airplanes will be a huge achievement.
Yeah. As long as we're on the subject of transportation, what is the future of this? I don't exactly understand how they work, but one of your things that made the list is Google's self-driving cars.
Yeah, so this is interesting. This is the product, something Google's been working on for a number of years now, in a lot of secrecy most of the time, but it's the product of a DARPA what they call a grand challenge years ago, which challenged teams to come together and create a car that's basically able to drive itself. And that doesn't mean people won't be in the car when the car is driving, but the car is capable of maintaining a distance from other vehicles on the highway and basically controlling, understanding its surroundings and reacting to them. And so Google has teams of engineers actually driving to and from work right now in these self-driving cars. So they're coming much, much closer to actually putting them on the highway. And the next hurdle, of course, before they can do that is to have states need to grapple with what that means to have self-driving cars on the highways, and they need to change regulations in order to make that possible.
Would you want to drive a self-driving car, Jennifer? I kind of like to drive. I would miss the driving experience.
There are many times when I'm tired and rolling down the highway that I would be perfectly happy to have the car take over for a while. So, yeah, I wouldn't want to totally cede driving to cars, but I think there's certainly some safety advantages to be had from your car being able to take control.
Mm. I think a lot of us thought of a certain age, and are getting older now, we used to dream when we were kids that we would have these little flying instruments on our backs so we could fly to school, or everybody would be flying. Whatever happened to that?
Ah, yes, the jetpack. The jetpack is perpetually around the corner. And every once in a while, in science news, you'll see progress. Someone they're still working on jetpacks out there. And every once in a while, you see an update where someone's gotten another foot or two off the ground. But we're still waiting for those. And we're waiting for the personal air vehicles that can land on your garage and whisk you off to work.
That would be fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be handy. Fly right over
I-95. Yeah. Now, this one, we did a show on this. I remember when this happened. But tell us how significant this is. The number of proton collisions generated to find Higgs. Actually, I guess it's pronounced boson. I always mispronounce it. Is it boson, like subatomic particles?
I've heard it pronounced both boson and boson, so I'm afraid I'm not the last word on that. We'll have to ask a particle physicist.
Okay. How big a deal was that? What does that mean?
That was, it was a really big deal for physicists. What it means is that There's a giant proton collider called the Large Hadron Collider that was built to basically try to detect this Higgs boson. And it's the Higgs boson is the final piece of the standard model of particle physics. And what that means is that the standard model proposed that there are 17 subatomic particles that explain all physical existence. And the most important of all of those is this Higgs boson, because it's responsible for giving mass to all of the other particles. And it's the only one that hadn't been observed yet. And it's also the most difficult to observe. And that's why they had to build this giant Hadron Collider. So the fact that they don't know exactly if it's the Higgs boson yet, but they're sorting through the data and they found something or observed something that certainly looks a lot like it. So that would be the sort of final piece of this standard model, which kind of elegantly describes everything we experience in the universe. Mm.
So it gives us so many scientific experiments or discoveries like this. People always say it gives us a better understanding of how the universe started. And that certainly was a phrase that was associated with Higgs boson. Does it give us a better understanding of how it all started?
It does give us a better understanding of, I think, why everything on Earth exists. There are other experiments that are also looking to the origins of the universe, including the Planck spacecraft, which has been gathering it's been mapping and measuring cosmic background radiation. And in 2013, we're actually expecting the release of even more data in the craft's most recent findings. And that will sort of shed more light on what the universe might have looked like as it was first forming.
Do you spend a lot of time considering the nature of the work that you do, wondering why we exist?
Unfortunately, the publishing schedule doesn't leave a lot of time for that kind of pondering, but we certainly write a lot about people who do ponder just such things, and a lot of them do seem to fall in the world of physics and astronomy.
Mm-hmm. Maybe in retirement, huh? Why do I exist? Yeah. This is a bizarre story. Tell us more about it. I think it was the Italian scientists who were given sentences because they didn't predict an earthquake?
Yes, this was something that really sort of set the scientific world on edge. It made everybody quite uncomfortable. In Italy, there was a 6.3 magnitude earthquake, and there were four scientists and two engineers that were recently convicted for up to 6 years of imprisonment for failing to predict or adequately warn the public of this impending earthquake. And as I understand it, there had been a series of smaller tremors in this region of Italy, and they didn't. It wasn't clear whether these tremors were leading to a much larger earthquake, or whether they were actually sort of releasing energy from the earth and sort of dissipating the risk. And the earthquake hit, and these scientists and engineers are the ones that were sort of left on the hook by the Italian court system. And you know, earthquakes are incredibly difficult to predict. When you think about our ability to predict the weather 10 days out, earthquakes are a lot harder than that. And so the fact that these scientists are being held culpable for not notifying the public of this event was happening and exactly when it was happening, most scientists would never want to be responsible for that kind of communication. It's really the responsibility, I think, of public officials to take the information that scientists are offering and to look at what region of the country your city is in. And if it's an earthquake-prone area, you need to take steps to make it more earthquake-proof.
Well, it would make you think twice about becoming a scientist, wouldn't it?
Well, and it would really make scientists think twice about the level of communication that they're offering the public, and also whether they're willing to be on government boards and involved in public planning at a level in which the insight they're offering might actually be sort of held against them at a later date.
Yeah. Our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. Jennifer Bogo is articles editor of Popular Science Magazine. Worth a read this month because they have the big science stories of 2012 and also expectations for 2013. Gary in Boscobel is calling in. Hi, Gary.
Thank you, Kathleen. In your last hour, you talked about the fiscal cliff and how dangerous it could be. And I wanted to point out that I'm a firm believer that there is an ecological cliff. And I think that we've stepped off of that cliff and we're in free fall. And I wanted to ask your guests about how we could possibly deal with that kind of a dire situation. We don't seem to want to talk about the consumption of resources, ongoing human population, and the extinction of species, and all of these are issues we have to deal with to slow down this freefall that we've stepped into ecologically. And I'm just wondering whether we'll start to deal with those issues in the future.
Jennifer,
that is a great question. You know, as I mentioned earlier, these two big scientific reports that are coming out regarding climate change this year are really an opportunity for discussion around that topic and for the media to remind people that this is an area of scientific consensus. This is what all of the data, the peer-reviewed research is telling us is what's happening to our climate and what will happen to it in the years and decades to come. And, you know, we do see examples in the media of information being distorted. For example, I think it was this October that the Met Office in the UK released a giant data set, sort of updating their global temperature data set. And what it showed was multi-decadal warming. And it was reported in the news, at least one news outlet cherry-picked the data and said that came to the conclusion that global warming stopped 16 years ago. And that was the headline that ran. And that was re-reported. I mean, that was that same report was also run by other news outlets. And so that was extremely misleading. And the Met Office said that, but by that point, the damage had been done. So this summer and fall is a good opportunity to sort of reiterate what the science is actually saying.
Thank you, Gary, so much for your call and concern. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation on this New Year's. It's not Eve yet, right, until noon, but New Year's Eve day. We're talking about science and the big science stories of 2012, and there are a variety of stories. As you can tell, we have many more to come. Welcoming phone calls, our number 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. And reading this article has given us ideas for shows in 2013. We love doing science shows and have done a number of them, actually, in 2012, and space shows. We'll talk about space as well. We're down to the last day to make your year-end gift to WPR, and asking you to do so today. Of a few hours left, you'll have a good feeling of supporting the station that you love, and you'll also have a tax deduction for 2012. It's not too late. Go to WPR.org, click donate, and thank you for all of your support. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jennifer Bogo is our guest this hour, articles editor of Popular Science Magazine. Please feel free to join our conversation anytime. 800-486-8655 is our number. We'll move into space stories in a moment, but let's spend some time, Jennifer, talking about this crowdfunding, which you say pays off. It has to do, it's a part of the Jobs Act. What is that?
Sure. The Crowdfund Act was actually part of the Jobs Act that was signed in April. What it would do is allow new businesses to make IPOs, and it would allow people who now back projects on sites, crowdfunding sites like Kickstarter, to actually become investors and become small-scale venture capitalists. Right now, sites like Kickstarter, they raise something like almost $3 billion in 2012. But those aren't actually investments. People are backing projects. They're getting gifts in return. In some cases, it's loans. But they don't get anything if the product then takes off in the future. And so this is sort of would be a win-win for these small companies and for the people who are interested in investing small amounts of money in them, because it would give the would free these small companies from having to depend on banks and angel investors. And if people's pick winners, then they stand to benefit as well. Mm. And the really exciting thing is that actually innovation across the board stands to benefit, because if this new influx of sort of money that's going, it's being spread widely across a lot of different ideas, stands to really supercharge, as we like to say, innovation.
You must know all about innovation in your job. It's interesting that there are all these people all over the world who are doing extraordinary things, and we don't hear about them that often. I mean, I read the list of what you focused on in popular science stories, the big stories of 2012, and I thought a lot of us don't know anything about this, which is not good.
We love to seek out innovation, whether it's something that's happening at the academic, the university level, or something that's happening within an agency like NASA. That's popular science, loves to write about that. But we also love to write about innovation that's happening on the level of people's garages and in people's basements. And we're actually right now preparing our annual inventors issue, in which we're looking at just that. We're looking at people who have an idea and who've made a working prototype, and it's something that's sort of poised to be a game changer and to sort of really solve an existing problem. And so I believe on our website today actually is our call for entries for that. So we're looking for people who are innovating right now for an upcoming issue.
Ooh, what's the website?
It's www.popularscience.com.
Okay. And I'm always amazed how many people there are out there who are inventors.
Yes. You know, I think people have, especially right now, people have a real desire to create things with their own hands. And so we're seeing a growth of things like hackerspaces across the country. Now there's in a lot of major cities, there are these spaces where people can take lessons in things like welding and woodworking, and also even computer design and Etsy-like crafts, like quilting with LED lights. Or you can just pay a membership fee and have the workspace and the tools to sort of pursue your ideas. And so these kinds of spaces are really, I think, enabling people to follow their sort of passions.
Hmm. And this issue will come out in February? Or later?
The Inventors issue will be in May, actually. So okay. We're now gathering issues for or entries for this.
All right. Well, mark
package.
Us down for an interview with you at that time. We'd love to.
Great. I'll
love
be back.
To do that. All right. And it's popsci.com in case you have an invention you want everybody to know about. This caught my attention. Now, here's a story I hadn't heard about at all. Animals sue for rights. Dolphins, chimpanzees, elephants, and parrots show capabilities uniquely human, including language like communication, complex problem solving, seeming self-awareness. By the end of 2013, looking ahead, the Non-Human Rights Project is going to file suits on behalf of select animals. I hadn't heard that story.
That's interesting. You know, there have been a number of scientific studies recently that have indicated animals like dolphins and elephants. There are several bird species that really show or exhibit skills and qualities that we've considered to be uniquely human. And that's really sort of forcing us to evaluate what it means to be human. And thus, it's also causing some people to ask, does that mean that we should extend rights, like the right to not be imprisoned, for example, to species that exhibit these human-like qualities? And so there is an organization that plans to sue on the behalf of some specific species or specific animals, probably by the end of 2013. Hmm. And that will put it in front of the court system, which will be really an interesting turn of events.
It will. Is this an American group, the Non-Human Rights Project?
I believe it is. Right. Not 100% sure, but I'm pretty certain.
A lunar mission, talking about people who are taking matters into their own hands. Let's talk about space for a while. There are teams who are competing, privately funded groups, to safely land a robot on the moon and explore its surface. This is a competition of some kind, Jennifer?
Yes, this is one of the X Prizes. And there have been a number of teams that have been competing to build a lunar lander, something that can safely land a robot on the moon, explore its surface. And we haven't actually seen any of these lunar landers that are being built make the trip yet. But right now, there's one company, Astrobotic, which has actually enlisted SpaceX to launch their lander and their rover as soon as December 2013. So we may see that turn of events this year as well.
How much of space exploration is being done privately now with a change in NASA missions, with not funding what we used to fund?
You know, it's interesting. I think we've seen NASA has continued sort of to have its perpetual struggle over being able to fund both Earth projects and also space exploration. So satellites that look back on Earth and give us more information about the place we live, and then also sending things like Curiosity, which is an incredibly ambitious mission to Mars, and then pondering what's the next step for humans. Are we going to go back to the moon? Are we going to try to go to an asteroid? And it's done some remarkable things while doing that balancing act. But we're also seeing this year entrepreneurs stepping in and doing what traditionally has been the undertakings of government. And certainly space is one of those areas. This year, we saw SpaceX send their Dragon capsule to dock with the International Space Station. And that was the first time a private spacecraft has ever docked with the space station. And SpaceX was started by Elon Musk. And so that was a really interesting turn of events. And what we might be seeing is the point at which NASA might be contracting with private companies to turn over some of these functions so that they can, like resupplying the space station, so that they can focus on other things.
What other things?
So they can focus on, for example, Mars rovers like Curiosity, mm-hmm. sort of furthering their exploration in the solar system. You know, we've also seen that entrepreneurship in other ways in 2012. We've seen James Cameron, for example, descended to the Marianas Trench, which was the deepest point in the oceans. That hasn't been done in 50 years, and it was done by, I believe, a Navy pilot before. And so Cameron largely funded building his own submarine, and it was an incredibly innovative design, and actually repeated that trip only solo. Before, there were two pilots, and he did it on his own. So it was the first solo trip to the deepest point in the ocean. We also saw a Red Bull-funded effort, Red Bull Stratos, which sent had a man literally skydive from the stratosphere, which is an amazing feat. Also,
yes.
Has not been done in 50 years.
Yes.
And that was a privately funded effort. It was a very scientifically run effort, which is why it was successful. But it was something that was done 50 years ago by the Air Force, and this year it was done by Red Bull. And it's a really interesting sort of trend.
Mm-hmm. And it was one of those experiences that just sort of came upon us. I didn't read a whole lot about it before it happened. And then all of a sudden there was the day and this remarkable feat was taking place.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was actually in Roswell when it happened.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, I was. I had followed it. There was a big push of media maybe 2 years ago, and then there was a court case that sort of put the whole project on hold for about a year. So everything with the project got very quiet. Felix Baumgartner, the gentleman who did this himself, struggled with some issues, claustrophobia, being in the spacesuit, and so he had to work through those. And so you're right, it was very quiet, and then all of a sudden the date was announced, and this whole project had been moving along over the course of this time where no one was really talking about it. And so I got the notice maybe a month before it happened, and so I was anxious to see him pull it off, because it's an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. You have to have this very fragile balloon carry you up there on what is effectively a spaceship. It's a space capsule. You have to have a space suit that's going to protect you as you're jumping into a vacuum and hurtling towards Earth. Yeah, and you need all these backup systems to make sure that if something goes wrong, your parachute goes off, and that you don't enter this sort of deadly spin that could really knock you out and kill you on the way down. So it was pretty exciting.
How much do you know about him? Why he did this, and what kind of training he underwent, the years of training to do this feat?
Well, he's an interesting person. He was a Red Bull, sort of one of their sponsored extreme sports guys. He had set a lot of records before for base jumping and skydiving off of the lowest object. He had flown with a carbon fiber wing over the English Channel. So he'd done a lot of extreme things. He certainly had the sort of disposition and the willpower and the discipline to do something, I think, like this, which became increasingly clear as the project went on. But he spent years, he had to learn to sit in that spacesuit in a capsule with very little room. He had to learn to bungee jump. Well, he had to learn to parachute, and he first started by bungee jumping in this spacesuit, which for a skydiver is one of the greater challenges, because you're used to being able to feel the air around you, to be able to steer yourself and orient your body in space. And when you're wearing something that's effectively sort of like being inside of like a pressurized football, you suddenly lose those capabilities. So he did train for a long time, and he had quite a large team that drew from the Air Force, and it drew from NASA, and it drew from private aerospace companies. And so a lot of people were interested in making this happen for both I think for both the sort of audacity of doing it, but also there was he was very well instrumented when he went up and when he jumped. So they have a lot of data points that they're currently sifting through. And there were also some interesting sort of scientific developments to come out of it already. For example, they developed a system to treat someone if they actually experience sort of anoxic shock on the way down. If you pass out in space and you start to, all the air starts to sort of bubble out of your body, they actually adapted a system to be able to treat people, which is very relevant to the space, to the, right, the space exploration. Huh.
Do we have any more of these coming up in 2013 of different forms, these extreme events, these, so we won't be caught by surprise next year?
That is a great question. I will be caught by surprise as of now, because I'm not aware of anything quite so extreme. As it was really unusual that, in particular, Cameron and Baumgartner, that they happened so sort of close to each other within the same year, and that they broke 50-year-old records. And interestingly, each one on his sort of team had the person who had done it 50 years ago. So Baumgartner worked with Joe Kittinger, who had set the record as an Air Force test pilot, and Cameron had the Navy pilot there with him. He was on the ship as Cameron descended down.
Mm-hmm. And there's another thing we keep hearing about all of these identification of everything that's in the ocean and those huge projects underway. There's something that's right there, and I would imagine that over the next decade we're going to see some remarkable discoveries in from the ocean, don't you think?
I think we will, definitely. We're certainly refining the technology that's, for example, that can explore places like under the ice shelf in Antarctica. There's a lot of exciting things happening with these very otherwise simple gliders that push air in and out, sort of move ballast around. They're basically operated on a whole bunch of D batteries, but they can explore places where humans can't go, and environments in ocean waters that are extremely cold, or they can travel extremely long distances. You don't have to worry about storms. There's several of them that explore off of the East Coast that are associated with Rutgers University. There's the teams that take them to Antarctica. And then people are also going to be looking to the ocean to learn more about ocean acidification, which is the more negative side to the ocean picture in the future. We're trying to understand what happens as the ocean is warming and the chemistry is changing, and what is the effect going to be on coral reefs and on different kinds of ocean life. And so there's a lot of research going into that as well.
Talking about the big science stories of 2012 and some that we may be witnessing in 2013, this New Year's Eve day, our guest is Jennifer Boko. She's articles editor for Popular Science magazine. There may be some that have caught you by surprise. You didn't know this happened. There may be some that you would like to comment on. What do you think about animals suing for rights? That would have profound ramifications. What about all the places that have dolphins perform and zoos that have certain kinds of animals, this granting, we have to do a show on this down the road, don't we? Capabilities, animals that show capability of uniquely human behavior, and so that should be protected. What about space? Do you welcome a change in the mission? And we'll talk more about the mission of NASA. What do you think we can applaud that has been done in the last year? What about these private missions that may receive some government funding, but mostly companies who are doing lunar missions, race to the moon to land robots and explore the surface of the moon? What about climate change? Our guest talked about two statements on climate change, which will set the record straight as long as nuanced differences from past reports are not exaggerated. Will that make a difference in moving ahead on what needs to be done to combat a warming planet? What about some of the, and we have yet to talk about more about this, some of our missions, Curiosity mission landing on Mars. Do you think that we need more of those? There are some very interesting things concerning a satellite going up, space exploration, a hugely ambitious undertaking, which we'll hear more about. Italian scientists convicted of manslaughter for failing to warn the public before a 6.3 magnitude earthquake. What do you think about that? What do you think of biofuels? What do you think about biofuels? Is that our future? What do you think about self-driving cars? Would you like to drive one of those? What do you think? Call us, 800-486-8655 for the big science stories of 2012. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Because this is New Year's Eve, we're down to the last day to make your year-end gift to WPR. You'll have a great feeling of supporting this station, and you'll also have a tax deduction for 2012. Go to WPR.org, click donate, and we thank you very much. Let's go to phone calls. There you are, Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Oh, hi. This is going to be a great year in science. The thing I'm most excited about is I understand there's going to be a new comet that we're going to see later this year that they predict may even get so bright it will be brighter than a full moon.
Wow.
It's supposedly a once-in-a-lifetime comet that probably won't come around for another million years or so, and it sounds rather exciting.
It sure does, Jennifer.
It will be exciting. It will be exciting. You're exactly right. There's a comet. It's now passing between the orbits of Jupiter and Saturn, I believe, and it should be visible in December. And it could be, experts are saying, as luminous as a full moon. We actually had a hard time when we were putting together this package for Popular Science's Year in Science, choosing between 2013 space events, because there were so many sort of exciting things on the horizon for space.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm a space junkie, so I'm always tuned into what's going on with that. And I think last year was just tremendous with the Spitzer telescope producing more and more incredible results, and Felix's jump was just incredible to watch. And I'm just really looking forward to next year. I just wish that we would double the NASA budget so NASA could start being what it once was, and just get more people out in space. People are the way to go.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I love the robots, but people are the way to go.
Ideally, you're right. There's something about sending humans sort of to push into new territories. I think that will always really excite people and get people behind space exploration. It was also really interesting to me to see how NASA actually handled the Curiosity rovers launch and landing, because it also, I feel like NASA was able to gather public enthusiasm behind that mission in a way that they had never quite done before with their social media efforts. I think people, I know a lot of people, they showed it actually in Times Square in New York City. They showed the landing. There were hundreds, if not thousands, of people standing in Times Square looking up at the big screen to see, to watch sort of the first images that Curiosity took on Mars. So, it's always exciting to see what's happening on the horizons of space.
Mm-hmm. Jim, thanks so much for the call. We go to Al in Sun Prairie next. Hi, Al.
Hi. Fabulous guest, fabulous. A question
for you,
and that is, have you seen scientific articles that took the likely consequences of climate change and massive crop failure massive human migration when the waters rise and force people out of areas like Bangladesh and Florida and plus such as that, and how they might produce human catastrophes such as wars and famine and with massive crop failures. With that kind of dramatic impact, I can't see how we don't end up with huge wars, which are essentially organized theft. But I'd like a scientific-level article by saying which areas are going to be flooded, which areas would lose crops, and then guessing who's going to be fighting.
You know, researchers are certainly looking at that. I don't have that information on the tip of my on my fingertips, but I can tell you that one of the entities that's most interested in that is actually the Department of Defense, because exactly as you said, when it's going to sort of shift global politics, it's gonna create tensions in parts of the world that maybe didn't exist before. It's certainly going to create pressures in other parts of the world that we need to be aware of. And so I think if you actually, I remember seeing them before. I don't remember the exact content, but I know there are studies that the government has actually done to look into that very thing.
Thank you so much, Al, for your call. Here's an email from Janet in Oak Creek who asks, what may be the effect of 3D copying and inventors and invention? How will 3D copying affect making prototypes or even manufacturing?
That's a really interesting question. That's sort of has gone a little bit hand in hand with the growth of these hacker spaces. There's now 3D printers started out as an open source thing, so you could actually sort of download the instructions and build your own. And there's also now a commercial 3D printer that you can buy. And so it's really opened up this world of printing everything from toys and hors d'oeuvres at parties to actually like human tissue and organs. I think one of the most exciting areas of 3D printing is actually in medicine, and it's interesting to see there's now a researcher that's working on printing skin grafts. It would be a sort of a mobile device. There are people working on printing things like bone. Right now it's sort of only at the level where it could be like a dental implant, but they're hoping to get to actual load-bearing bone. So it's poised to change, I think, a lot of different industries. And in fact, I was actually at a bar in New York City right before the holidays where there was a lot of ping pong and pool. And one of the bartenders told me they had one of these 3D printers on display in the bar. And we got to talking about it. And he said, oh, yeah, we've rented the place upstairs and we're going to build a 3D printing shop so that can come and rent the 3D printers and print things. And so it's sort of entering spaces that maybe you wouldn't expect it to enter as well.
You never know where you're going to find your next story, right, Jennifer?
Exactly.
Yeah. There's also in the magazine this, you call it one of the most ambitious undertakings in the history of space exploration, will create this next year a 3D map of 1 billion stars.
Yes, that's the Gaia satellite. It launches in 2013, and it's going to map, as you said, 3D map a billion stars, which is 1,000 times more than the previous mission. And that's another thing that's sort of going to help astronomers really understand sort of the origins, in this case, of the Milky Way. So it's pretty exciting. It'll be cool to see what comes out of that that mission as well.
Stephanie in Arcadia, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to comment about the potential lawsuits related to the animal rights, and with that in mind, with the animals being kept in the zoos, what would be the impact of releasing those animals into the wild if we're going to be doing a suit on their rights?
I don't know. That all remains to be seen when this thing hits the court system. You know, the first suit won't be on the behalf of all animals that exhibit sort of human-like capabilities. It'll be on the behalf of a specific, I think it has to do with the legal system. It'll be on the behalf of a specific animal. And so it'll be interesting to see how that ripples out to affect the way we handle species in captivity and the way they're sort of handled for other uses as well.
Mm. We'll definitely be doing a show, guarantee you, within the next month, because I love these shows about what elephants can do and dolphins, and we find all that terribly interesting. So stay tuned, please, Stephanie. Max in Appleton, hi.
Hello, good morning. Good morning to you. I have a quick comment on the issue you were discussing a few minutes ago concerning the Italian seismologists condemned by a
yes.
judge for their responsibilities during the earthquake mm-hmm. in 2009 in Italy.
Yes.
Unfortunately, this event has not been reported correctly in the mainstream American media. The scientists have not been condemned because they did not forecast an earthquake. I mean, scientists, of course, are not magicians, and even Italian judges know this. The judges condemned the scientists because they demonstrated that the scientists have been pressured by politicians who have also been condemned to lie. Basically, the scientists knew perfectly what was going on those days in central Italy, and that the tremors could become stronger and stronger. However, they have been pressured to release a statement inviting the people who had been sleeping outside in their cars for weeks, they invited basically the people to go back to their houses because, and here I quote, enough energy had already been released. So because of this false statement, and the scientists knew perfectly that that was not the truth, for this statement they have been condemned of manslaughter. Basically, they have been condemned because they did not behave like scientists, but they were convinced or pressured by this politician who then was the leader of what can be defined as the kind of Italian National Guard. They have been convinced by him to release this statement, and that was a lie. And they demonstrated all of this because they had some they intercepted some telephone conversation.
Jennifer,
yeah, interesting. That's a wrinkle that I hadn't heard expressed quite so strongly, I guess, before. I know that the conviction had to do with their statements before the earthquake actually unfolded, and they basically, the nature of the statements reassured people that the earthquake would not lead to a large earthquake. So it was clearly a complex situation, but nonetheless, it's made scientists everywhere pretty nervous.
Mm-hmm. You want to write a letter to Popular Science to give more information on that. We had Harry from Madison wants to know, and this is one of the stories we didn't get to yet, heredity may not be limited to DNA.
Yes, that was interesting. So they discovered that there are other sugars that can form nucleic acid backbones that can actually hold genetic information. So, and they are calling these XNAs, but it's basically a different... It's not DNA, but there are other nucleic acid backbones that can pass along that information. And so that sort of raises some interesting questions, including can these be used to create life? So it's certainly a rich area of research.
Cassidy writes, I love this one. The idea of the jetpack is alive and well in my family. My 5-year-old son had one on his Christmas list to Santa, who was unfortunately unable to deliver this year. Santa wrote to him that he might be ready for one when he's old enough.
That is a future Popular Science reader, if I ever heard of one. That's fantastic. I'm excited. That's what he
great.
Asked for.
Yeah, it's great. That's a future developer of the...
Yes, future engineer.
Exactly.
Jetpacks.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And finally, we have about a minute left. I'm wondering how important this one is, a supercomputer to treat cancer patients.
That's interesting. That was the IBM supercomputer that was actually got a lot of attention for playing Jeopardy and learning the same skills it used to learn how to play Jeopardy and succeed at doing that can actually be applied to diagnosing and suggesting treatments for cancer. It can sort vast amounts of information for what's important. And so the people at Memorial Sloan Kettering are actually using Watson, this computer, and they're training it to treat a few different cancers, I believe, including prostate cancer. And maybe breast cancer, but they're breast, lung, and prostate, and they're basically going to be using Watson as a tool, and they're going to start in 2013 to distribute it more widely to other clinicians.
Hmm. Well, Jennifer, this has been fascinating. Let's stay in touch during 2013, and we're happy to talk about many of these stories. It was a great hour filled with information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you. May you find great stories in unexpected places.
And see you as well.
Thanks. Jennifer Bogo, articles editor for Popular Science Magazine, the big science stories of 2012 and those we will anticipate in 2013. Oodles of show ideas from that magazine as well. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. Happy New Year to you. We'll be with you again on Wednesday at 9:00.